What's going on, everybody? Well, let me set my headphones right. You've got the Rational Revolution. This is Mark, your host. And I didn't say my last name because the guy that's here shares it. It's John Becker, my brother.
Hello.
Hello. Here he is. And this is kind of a cool episode. We're going to mark the last weekend of Pride Month. And we're going to talk to my brother about a whole bunch of things related to his life, his experiences. We're going to talk about gay rights, where we are, what we have to do, and all that kind of stuff. So I hope you enjoy joining us on this discussion. And I'll try not to, we'll keep the inside jokes to the minimum, I suppose. I'll try.
You can try.
Yeah, we'll see. But yeah, so I'm so honored to have you here. I'm really glad that you're here.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm excited.
Yeah, I think, and for our listeners, and I don't want to, you know, overstate it or understate it or whatever, but you have a unique perspective on this, because not only being, you know, a gay man and growing up here in Wisconsin and all that, but you've really been a pretty driving force between a lot of the modern fights for equality that have happened in the last 15, 20 years in this country. You know, you've been there, you've done things, and it's pretty cool. So I really want to hit on a lot of that. You know, I normally start asking the guests, you know, how did you get involved in blah? How did you do that? So I can't say like, oh, how did you, you know, but I guess I want to start with like, you know, how did you know when you were little, how did you know that you were gay?
So I guess I knew that, I was different long before I had any language that I knew any language to attach to that. It's not actually an easy answer, just because, like I said, that sense of difference came long before I had any verbiage for it. And because we grew up, even now, but even more so back in the 90s, early 2000s, when I was growing up and coming of age in a very homophobic society and in a, you know, not always welcoming part of the world. Mm-hmm. As soon as you even start to realize that you're different, you also immediately realize that is something that should be according to the culture and the people around you. That's something that should not be celebrated. That's right. Something that should be hidden, that should be kept silent, that you should be ashamed of. Which of course those are all lies, mm-hmm. but those are lies that are reinforced by societal prejudice, discrimination, and bigotry. So I was always different. I was into things. We in our culture have such a strange practice of attaching gender to so many things that don't need to be gendered. You know, right. It's as though only. Well, first of all, the idea that there are only two genders is not true, but yeah, as though only boys or girls can like certain colors or certain right. activities or you know, express themselves in certain ways, which is obviously not true. When your understanding of yourself falls sort of outside those arbitrary cultural expectations, you are reminded pretty quickly of your otherness, and it subjects you to a good amount of bullying and vitriol and ridicule along the way. So I first learned there's a slur that everyone knows that starts with the letter F for gay folks, and I learned the meaning of that word on the playground in elementary school.
Really?
So yeah, like other kids saw that too and clocked that in me too before I even fully understood it in myself. So I mean, like very, very, very early, those differences started to make themselves evident.
When did you accept that? You know, did it take a while to say, okay, well, this is me? You know?
Oh yes, very, very much so. Because I grew up at a time and in a place. So I want to preface this by saying that, I'm very lucky and blessed to have parents and a family who are welcoming and loving of me. In the fullness of myself.
Yes, that's
not true for many LGBTQ
right.
people now.
Right.
That was even more not true for many LGBTQ people in the 90s and early 2000s when I was growing up. You know, 40% of homeless youth in this country are LGBTQ, and the reason for that is because there are still so many children, teenagers who are gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, non-binary, et cetera, who when they discover that about themselves, their families respond with rejection. They kick them out into the streets. They say that because of who you are no longer welcome in my home. You are no longer my child. And they cast their own children out into the streets. So 40% of homeless youth in this country are LGBTQ. So I'm very lucky to have, to have a family who loves me for who I am. That said, you know, I still grew up in a time and in a place, and in a family where there were lots of misconceptions and misunderstandings, or just lack of education about LGBTQ people. When you grow up in that society, you absorb those messages, you absorb those feelings of inferiority or of self-loathing and things like that. So when I first really began to grapple with the fact that I'm different in that way, you know what I mean? My own difference. And I realized that difference, that I'm gay, that's the word for that. And that's, you know, I ran away from that, or I tried to, you know, sort of a pendulum thing. You know how sometimes the people who protest the loudest are the ones who are also dealing with it themselves. I ran toward conservative politics and religion to try to, you know, because I didn't want that to be part of me. Even though, of course, we know you can't change your sexual orientation any more than you can change your hair color or eye color. I thought that if I prayed hard enough, if I was just good enough for God, that God would take it away, you know, which sounds so silly to say out loud as a grown, well-adjusted adult. But when everything in society teaches you to be ashamed of yourself, it makes a lot more sense in your brain, which is a sad commentary on society. So to make a long story long, no, I did not embrace that part of myself right away. It took a very long time, and it wasn't until I unsuccessfully attempted to take my own life in high school that was sort of a turning point for me, in that It finally sort of crystallized in my mind that, you know, nothing could take that away from me, take that out of me. So, you know, maybe it's not supposed to be taken away. Maybe it's actually supposed to be in there. Mm-hmm. And in my mind, I was still framing it in terms of God. So it's like, maybe, you know, maybe if God hasn't taken this away, then God put it there in the first place. It's supposed to be there. And that sort of helped me to sort of start off on that, take those first steps toward affirmation. I don't like the word acceptance, because acceptance to me sounds like something, you know, you accept things.
That is what it is, right, yeah.
Yeah, you accept things that you can't change but you don't particularly like, you know, like a cancer diagnosis or you know, or the Packers losing to the Vikings or something like that. Like, you accept it even if you don't like it.
Right.
LGBTQ people don't deserve just acceptance. They deserve embrace. They deserve welcome. They deserve love and affirmation. We deserve those things. So that's why I dance around the word acceptance, because I don't think that goes nearly enough for what every person deserves for who they are and who they love.
Right. Do you think some of those terms are, you know, used by people that just don't know the right term is affirmation, you know, like.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I'm a writer, and I'm a, I think about language. I think about language very precisely and very meticulously. And, you know, but that's not where everybody is, and that's not how everybody speaks. And, you know, I think that in our journeys together, like I said, that was why I said, I stay away from those words, because I like to encourage people to think further and to think beyond the words that we use that and the constraints that they may place. But I'm also not going to, you know, come up to anybody and be like, you're not, you know, I think that we should meet people where they are and walk with them, walk together with them versus, you know, I don't think it serves anybody. It gets us any further along on the journey towards justice and equality to sort of, you know, look down our nose at people and be holier than thou about stuff. That doesn't accomplish anything, but patting ourselves on the back, that doesn't actually get anything done.
Right. No. And that's, you know, I think, and we're going to talk about that, you know, about what you've done to move the needle and get things done. And so do you know, who was the first person that you said those words, I am gay? Do you know who that was, or do you?
I sure do.
Sure. We got a minute left in the second.
And because, you know, he and I to this day, it's sort of not a joke, because it's true, but, you know, it's a sort of a, you know, inside sort of reference for the two of us. I call him my gay godfather. his name was Robert Ledley. And
Rob. Oh, cool.
Yes. Yes.
And Rob's wonderful.
He was the only out gay person at my high school. He was a senior when I was a freshman. And he was in theater and so drama club and in show choir and all, you know, and all the activities that I was in.
All
and
around good was, guy.
Yes. Oh yes. You know, very talented, very extroverted, very involved, very, you know, and
very
and
kind.
I was those things too, but I was very, very, ashamed still about that part of myself. And here he was, fully unabashed and out there being himself and dealing with a lot of, I don't know if I'm allowed to say curse words on here, but dealing with a lot of BS from peers because of it. But still not letting that deter him. And I so admired that about him. And, so I was still very, much caught in sort of this dichotomy of starting to come to grips with, near acceptance, let alone affirmation.
Right.
And we're starting to come to grips with, my sexual orientation, but still sort of being very ashamed of it.
Yeah. We're going to continue this discussion in just a little bit here with John Becker. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Rational Revolution. You got Mark Becker here. We're talking with my eldest dear brother, John Becker. We're talking about what his life was like growing up as a gay man in Northeast Wisconsin. And we were just talking about a dear person, Rob Ledley, who I know a little bit, but the gay godfather. And I remember, you know, and I don't think I knew until you were out of high school and you were in college. Mm-hmm. Was that right? What was the timeline on that when you kind of told, you know, the family?
Yeah. So, apologies for the interruption in the break, but that was my freshman year of high school. It was the fall of my freshman year when I told Rob. It was, we were rehearsing for the fall play Our Town, and told him right there in the East High Auditorium. And I have to say, the moments before I first said those words out loud were some of the scariest moments of my life.
Oh, sure.
Even because, you know, it almost makes it real in a way that, you know what I mean? Like it is real, but it's giving voice to your truth that it's such a vulnerability, and it's such a, you know, and the same goes for the summer after my senior year, which is when I came out to mom and dad. Because, you know, you don't know how people are going to react. It's one of the most vulnerable moments that you'll ever experience. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're sharing a part of yourself that is it's intrinsic to you, but it's such a part of your core humanity. And it's a part of you that the world has taught you and everyone else around you to shun, to stigmatize, to misunderstand, to make fun of, to be afraid of, to all these things. It's a very, and even to this day, when someone comes out to you, that is a profound act of trust, of vulnerability, and it's a gift, really. You know, so I hope that anybody who's listening, who has someone in their life who, or, you know, in the future may come out to them, just realize what a gift and an act of love and vulnerability that is, that they are trusting you with that truth about themselves. So please keep that in mind when you receive it, even if you don't fully understand, even if you have questions, those things are normal, those things are natural. You know, we all have to educate ourselves when it comes to experiences and, life journeys and communities that we don't understand or aren't a part of ourselves. But in that moment, responding with love is so, so important, because that person is sharing such a deeply, deeply personal core part of themselves with you. Anyway, tangent aside, it was the summer after my senior year when I came out to mom and dad. That was May, thankfully, they freely said, like, you know, that there was a lot that they didn't know,
yes.
but they immediately in that moment said, but yeah, there's a lot that we don't know or understand, but we love you, and that will never change, and we always will. That was the message that they gave to me. And to their immense credit, they took the next step, which is they started to educate themselves, because, yes, you know, they're both music and theater people, but they also grew up in small town Wisconsin.
Right.
And, you know, so when you grow up in small towns, you sometimes, just by immersion, sometimes absorb sort of small town mindsets about certain things. So they were like, right, but this, what I had been told and what I have observed and absorbed through church and through my upbringing and things like that, those messages don't match the person, right, who my child is.
Right.
So, you know what I mean? So, what has to change? I have to change. And they took that upon themselves to do that.
I think that was interesting, because I remember talking with my brother John here, and I think, you know, I don't know if you told me before you told them. I think you did. But maybe I'm wrong, you would know more than I, but I remember when you told me, I was just like, yeah, okay. So I had no idea the profoundness. So I'm sorry about that. I didn't know. And I'm just, you know, thinking about that now of like, oh Jesus. Yeah.
Well, I could have done that better. You were just finishing your sophomore year in high school.
But then, you know, and it was interesting is, you know, looking at that summer, I mean, like, that was absolutely your hot girl summer. Like, you, and it was, but it was something that,
not wrong.
But looking back years later, what a relief that it must have been for years after, you know, of not knowing and hiding and being, you know, in secretive, you could celebrate who you are, embrace who you are, and be completely open and transparent and out of, this is who I am. I love that about me. And if you don't, you know, F you, whatever. But,
right.
And I think it was interesting and it was cool, you know, and our parents are incredibly supportive. You know, they founded the Adult Gay Straight Alliance in Green Bay. They've, you know, and I, so much of this show talks about personal growth. I talk about my own personal growth of being the Republican Party chair and now not being associated with that because of the amount of self-learning and reflection that I've had to go through. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, we look at our parents and our family and you know, dad, you know, he listened to tapes on his mail route. And so he would listen to, you know, some focus on the family stuff. And then he would reflect on it. And it's like, well, that doesn't make a lot of sense. And I remember mom sitting in, you know, in the living room, and she was telling me that, like, well, we're still learning, but the core value, and she says this, and I say this, all to this day. You know, the core value of anything is love, you know, and,
right.
and that was something, you know, love that they have for you. And mm-hmm. if you have love for whoever you are with, be it a man or a woman, then that love would transition into to whoever that person is. And so they will always mm-hmm. love you for that. And so that's cool. And I love mm-hmm. that. And, but there were some in our family that would, you know, say, we can fix this.
Right.
You know?
Oh, yeah.
And we had a, and this is not immediate family, but the, you know, is you just have to talk to girls, John. You know? And,
right.
And,
yes.
And how many people, yes. we got a minute left in the segment, and how many people face that? And it comes not from their outside family, but from their immediate family.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That, and like I said, that pain, there's almost nothing that can wound more deeply than that kind of rejection.
Right.
That's a trauma that's inflicted on LGBTQ people to this day who come out to their families and who are not met with that core value of love. I think it's important to lead with that whenever we can
right.
and to try to put that forth into the world.
Right. And that's exactly right. And I think that's why, you know, things like Pride Alive is so important and you know, Pride Month. And I always get a really good kick out of people who have issues with that. You know, right. It's like, oh, okay, whatever. But we're going to talk when we come back about the beginnings of your activism and the things that you did. So stick around. We'll be right back on The Rational Revolution.
Slapping time, I was holding Bobby's hand in mine. We sang every song that Javi knew. Busted flat in Baton Rouge.
Welcome back.
Waiting for a train.
I like this song. This song is an homage to the host that was here before. Her name is Chris Alfheim, and she's running for state senate, and she's wonderful, and her wife is wonderful. And John Becker's here. We're talking about, you know, we're celebrating Pride Month here, and we're talking about, you know, what life was like growing up and all of that. And I wanted to touch on, you know, what you've done in the movement. And I think it was, you know, I don't know if it was our Catholic upbringing that, you know, we were taught evangelizing and activism and, you know, random acts of, you know, get your bleep together. But, mm-hmm. you know, I think looking at what you've done and from little on, I mean, you've always were someone that would try to be a leader in whatever you did. And I mm-hmm. think, you know, you experienced at a young age what it was like to be a gay man in a different country. And you saw how other places really respected and honored and affirmed same-sex couples. And then you came back to the United States and, you know, found the exact opposite. And the things that you saw from, you know, when you were coming into your own in terms of the activism side, you know, you were part of the Act 10 protests. You saw that. You moved to Vermont and you took down Michelle Bachmann's presidential campaign, you know. And so just to let our listeners know, Michelle Bachmann was a presidential candidate, very fundamental, wacko, Christian conservative candidate. And her husband was a psychologist or psychiatrist or whatever. And he...
A Christian counselor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, right on. And he accepted federal dollars for like Medicare or whatever it was. And by doing that, you can't perform services like reparative therapy. That's horrifically dangerous to people. So like the pray away, the gay stuff. And there was a, you know, the Michelle Bachmann, we don't do that. We don't, you know, da, da, da. Well, you went into the old Bachmann center. And they did that therapy on you with mm-hmm. a camera.
Mm-hmm.
It's how difficult was that to get into that mindset, to be like, to be put in that place?
You know, it was very, like, like you just sort of like a record scratch fast forward. Yeah, it was a very interesting. I actually sort of had to draw on. So your listeners may know this as well about our family, but we are a family of musicians and performers. So like we've been immersed in that kind of that culture and that training ever since we were able to speak, really, you know. So I really had to draw on that, and my degrees are in vocal performance as well, so I have lots of experience and training as a performer. And as a performer, you are telling a story, you are inhabiting a character, you are, you know, all those sorts of things. And I really did have to draw on that training to step into that. The tough part for me was that, because I had never done anything like this before. Obviously, I'd never, you know, never gone undercover with hidden cameras and gone to quote unquote therapy sessions to pray away the gay. So in order to minimize the chance of getting caught up, you know, in a lie, you know, I decided to make my character match as closely as possible to my own experience growing up as a, you know, self-loathing gay person, a person who didn't want to be gay, who thought that God wouldn't love me if I allowed myself to be who I was, you know what I mean? So I was surprised by how much that took out of me, you know, like how much energy it took to step back into that, you know, 15, 16, 17-year-old sort of self-loathing version of myself. It was a lot of work. But it was worth it because, like you were saying before, the Bachman Clinic had long been rumored to engage in pray away the gay type of, you know, quote unquote conversion therapy, but they had always denied it, and nobody had ever gone in and sort of independently tried to confirm or refute those rumors. But when this was in the 2012 primary, so it was July of 2011, and it was during that election cycle, the Republican candidates, all, there were like 300 of them, and they all had their moment in the sun, you know, where they were the flavor of the month.
Oh, yeah.
It was Rick Santorum, and Michelle Bachman. Right. And when it was Bachman's turn, like anytime that presidential spotlight gets on you, reporters start, you know, start investigating and digging into your background, because, yes, and you know, people want to know about you and your life and your experiences and things like that. And so a reporter was sort of digging into these rumors, and the organization I was working for at the time, it was called Truth Wins Out, run by Wayne Besson, who has done a lot of this work over the years. And in the, you know, fighting back against the pray away the gay lie,
right,
the, you know, the conversion therapy industry that's so dangerous and damaging and fraudulent.
So and we still alive.
The go-to, what is it?
And still around.
Oh yes. Yes. That lie is still has currency, believe it or not. Yep. Yeah. Yeah, but we were sort of the go-to organization for that, mm-hmm. And so we decided that we would, you know, we would attempt to see for ourselves whether or not they were offering this. And he had done, you know, he was sort of was well known enough in terms of as a conversion therapy fighter, you know, as an anti-conversion therapy fighter that exposes these lies, that he would have been quite possibly recognized if he had gone in himself.
Oh, yeah.
So. The decision was made to send
you're up.
Me. And So
didn't you see Marcus Bachman like years later, like just recently?
So no, I've only ever spoke with Marcus on the phone. I did, however, meet Michelle.
Oh, that's what it was. Yes.
Yes. I was in Israel for
that's
a trip with
right.
the Wider Bridge, which is a group that connect it's a progressive Jewish LGBTQ organization that connects LGBTQ leaders in the United States and Israel to build relationships and to advance equality in both countries. And so I was on an LGBTQ leaders trip to Israel with the Wider Bridge, and there was the speaker that morning was running late. I ran up to the lobby to grab some coffee because we were out late the night before and I needed to wake up. And I got up the stairs and there was Michelle Bachman herself.
Oh my God.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it was. I walked right up to her and introduced myself and got a little awkward selfie before I told her why I wanted to meet her. And she,
what did she say?
She said, "Oh, okay, nice talk to you. Bye." Real fast and turned on her heels and walked away really quickly.
Yeah, you took down her presidential campaign, which is hilarious. Yeah.
It was certainly the first major roadblock.
Oh God, you were
campaign. Absolutely.
You were everywhere, and you were on all the national news stations and all of that because it was a huge, huge story.
Yeah, and this was 2011, but even then, in sort of blue state America, a lot of people didn't realize that this was still going on, and that many people.
Right.
Still believe that you could pray away the gay. It shined. The thing I'm proudest of, and you're right, it was the front page of the New York Times, and it was the lead story on ABC World News Tonight, and it was that media whirlwind was crazy. But what I'm proud of is that it really shined a national spotlight on that issue of conversion therapy. And in the years since, we saw the Obama administration come out against it. We saw states ban it for minors. We saw like all of this public awareness and many, many concrete steps toward toward rolling back or rather containing the harm caused by conversion therapy. It still is practiced, unfortunately. And there's only so much you can do because, you know what I mean? Like it's the whole private business thing and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. But there have been so many advances made in the years since. And this was sort of a catalyst for a lot of that. So that's the thing I'm proudest of is that it really, really helped to shine a spotlight and to sort of galvanize people into action on that issue.
Yeah. And I think that was definitely a very big moment in that fight. And so you went from Vermont and you wanted to go like directly into the epicenter of where everything is happening. And you landed in Washington, D.C.
Yes.
And I mean, you know, the stuff that you've done there, I mean, you have a sign and a picture in like the Smithsonian. You met Edie Windsor, who was the plaintiff in one of the incredibly historic cases, Jim Obergefell. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know these people, you're friends with these people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, how, I mean, talk about the experience there. I mean, like, my God.
Yeah. Well, you know, the Smithsonian stuff and Jim and Edie and things like that. So that was because I had been involved in marriage equality work since my now ex-husband and I were married in 2006. At that time, there was only one state in the country where LGBTQ folks with same-sex couples could get married. That was Massachusetts. But thanks to Mitt Romney, who was then the governor, he dusted off an old law that said that if you didn't live or sign an affidavit saying that you were moving to Massachusetts, you couldn't get married there. So we literally had to leave the country to get married. And when we did that and came back to Wisconsin, that was the year that Republicans were trying to get rid of Jim Doyle
and
kick him out of the governor's mansion. So in order to sort of gin up turnout on the conservative side, they put a marriage discrimination amendment on
That's
the ballot.
Right.
So we came right from getting married, and the newlywed glow hadn't even worn off, and we were having to sort of beg people not to doubly ban our marriage because Wisconsin already had a statutory ban on the books.
Right.
So you know, like, so there was no, it already was illegal, but these folks were trying to put that discrimination into the state constitution, and because it was 2006, they succeeded, that was devastating. It was absolutely gutting. To pour your heart out and to knock on doors and to make phone calls and to give speeches at rallies and things like that, and then to have your homeland, your home state, people that you walk past you on the street and smile at you, spit in your face, mm-hmm. and tell you that you are a second class citizen and that you are not worthy of the same rights and protections for the most important relationship in your whole life as they were. So that was a really devastating loss, but it was also galvanizing, and that's what sort of threw me into that work. And you know, in the years since, we testified in front of the legislature when they were thinking about and eventually enacted domestic partnership protections, speaking at rallies, were spokescouple for Fair Wisconsin, and then when I moved to DC, I was running an LGBTQ blog, a national LGBTQ blog for a long time.
Yep.
I was a founding member of Gays Against Guns and was arrested in, you know, an act of civil
disobedience. I was going to talk about that. Yes.
Yeah. Like, so just lots, all sorts of things. But,
I remember the phone call where you're like, you're like, I'm getting arrested tomorrow. I'm like, wait, what? You're like, I'm going to get arrested tomorrow. I'm like, the hell are you? Wait. Don't do that. And you're like, no. Like, yeah. No, we're protesting. But, I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm going on a tangent. But like, to get back to your Smithsonian and Supreme Court stuff,
yeah.
That was because you know, so I've been involved in the marriage equality yes. movement for years and years by that point. And so in 2013, when Edie Windsor's lawsuit came up to the Supreme Court, and she was suing the government to try to overturn the so-called Defense of Marriage Act.
What a remarkable woman, you know?
My goal in life is to live my life as fully as Edie did.
Oh my God! Right? Yeah.
That yes, she was just a remarkable woman. Mm-hmm. And so she won in the Supreme Court, and the so-called Defense of Marriage Act was struck down, meaning that all same-sex marriages that were legal in the states they were entered into, the federal government had to recognize them. It was a huge victory,
mm-hmm.
and my then husband and I, like, we were on the steps of the Supreme Court, and our just, you know, visceral reaction of joy was, you know, captured by all sorts of cameras and stock and photographers. And it was on the front page of, you know, of hundreds of newspapers all around the world. It was very surreal.
Yeah, that's crazy.
To be, you know, part of so many iconic photographs of that day. And that's the sign that I was holding that day is the one that's now in the Smithsonian collection. But afterwards, just through the LGBTQ movement, I was able to meet Edie and befriend her for the last couple of years of her life, and that was just such a joy. She was just an incredible, kind, tireless, brilliant, brilliant woman. So I was really fortunate to be able to call
right.
her.
Right, we're going to talk and about also, more of this here on the other side of the break. Yeah. We're going to talk about what DC is like. What do we have to do? Where are we? How far we've come, and the dangers that Donald Trump poses to equality. So we'll see you back in a little bit.
Sounds great.
What's going on, everybody? We're back on the Rational Revolution with Mark Becker. We are talking with my dear brother John Becker, who is obviously my brother, but he's a well-known figure in the fight for equality for LGBT rights here as we celebrate the last weekend of Pride Month. And I wanted to talk about, you know, we've talked about some of the landmark decisions that have happened and some of the big cases for equality and freedom. But I mean, there's a lot yet to do. You know, I just a week ago or 2 weeks ago, whatever it was, that stupid law where, you know, I think it's Louisiana where the Ten Commandments have to be in every single, that's going to be struck down like immediately by the Supreme Court. It should be by the Supreme Court. But you know, the hyper Christianitizing of our youth, you know, and some other laws that are, we're not all there yet in the fight for equality.
Any far from it. Yes.
Right. And so, you know, I want to talk a little bit about, you know, what are the threats that are on the horizon? Like what do we need to look out for?
I think we're looking at today is the day. I don't know when this program will air, but today, Thursday, June 27th, is the day of the presidential debate, the first one between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. And I cannot overstate to you the threat that Donald Trump, the danger that Donald Trump coming back to the White House would be to LGBTQ Americans.
Oh my God.
His administration, in his previous administration, was horrifically anti-gay and anti-trans. And the Republican Party, the MAGA Republican Party of 2024, is horrifically anti-gay and especially anti-trans. They have been they have made attacking transgender folks and their human rights a centerpiece of their campaign because it's not quite as culturally permissible to attack gay people as it used to be, but trans folks, they are a much smaller sliver of the population, so they're much more easily stigmatized because there's a lot of misinformation and a lot of people don't know about trans folks. So the Republicans have cynically used that to their advantage, and they are doing all sorts of horrific things in terms of transgender healthcare, transgender youth. They are trying to Donald Trump would kick trans people out of the military. Just on and on and on. They're at every level, and it's even in the Project 2025 horrific plan that's getting some rightful attention in the media. There are many items in Project 2025 that are specifically focused on attacking LGBTQ people in healthcare, in education, in employment discrimination, on and on and on. And at every level, a second Donald Trump administration would be horrifyingly dangerous for LGBTQ folks.
Well, it's
priority number one.
And it's laughable how, like, you know, people say, oh, well, Donald Trump, you know, he hugged a pride flag and waved it around. It's like, okay, that's, you know, no one has been more pro-LGBT than Donald Trump. That's what the supporters will say. But then, you know, in practice, what they've actually put into place has been completely the opposite.
Right. Exactly. You know, those things like hugging a pride, those are just empty, meaningless fig leaf gestures, you know, to give something for his base to hang on to say, oh, see, he's not a bigot. He hugged a pride flag. It's kind of like it's not dissimilar to how the Trump campaign will put it's three black supporters behind Trump at rallies and say, oh, see, we have a group called Black
Our
for
black
Trump,
friend, right?
Even,
yes.
You know, even though he's horrifically racist, his base is horrifically racist, and his policies are horrifically racist, and most black folks don't support him. But it's just to give them that fig leaf. But yes, like, you're exactly right. Don't look at what they say, look at what they do. And at every chance they have and will, if given power again, act to undermine and harm LGBTQ people.
Yeah, and from equality rights to racism to constitutional crisis. I mean, man, were we seconds from midnight, as the doomsday clock would say. Like we were perilously close, you know, and you know, you lived through that. You know, what was that? What was it like in D.C. on January 6th?
Oh gosh, on January 6th, that was such a it was surreal. My partner works at the Pentagon, and he was, you know, he's very chill, he's very easygoing, but he also knows that I am an activist at heart, and my first instinct is to, you know, if there's going to be some, if people
I'm gonna go down there,
trouble, it's to go down there and counter protest. And he was like, again, I don't know if I can save this person, but his life, and he never talks like this, but he was like, you sit your ass in that house and you don't come out. Like, and just he must have heard or just intuited that something was going to go on. And sure enough, he was right. It was surreal to be watching along with, you know, many, many other Americans across the country, the live feeds from the Capitol, and to see the mob of domestic terrorists, you know, attacking police officers and breaking windows and storming the Capitol and trying to hang the vice president and the Speaker of the House, and hearing those sirens of the on TV, and then opening the window or leaning out the front door and hearing them in your own neighborhood. I live on Capitol Hill, so, you know, I live, you know, a mile away from the Capitol. It's literally just down the road. If I stand in my neighborhood park, I can see it right down the street. So it's that close. So it was very surreal. You felt violated on almost like just like an elementary school civics level, right? Like, this is just not how we as Americans are supposed to resolve our differences. We're not supposed to be, you know, we're taught that we are a country of laws and of democracy and of free and fair elections and the peaceful transfer of power, and this violated all of that. So to see that happen, and then now in 2024 to see Donald Trump and the MAGA cult
he welcomed
to turn
back
that,
in yeah
yes into an act of heroism and valor is just, it's disgusting.
Right. And so we're coming up to the end of the program, and I do have to say, you know, thank you for joining, and I hope you come back, because there's so much that we're going to be talking to, you know, about that. And I love you so very much. I'm proud of you. Thank you for being here, and thank you for telling your story, John. You are a wonderful person, and I'm so glad you're in our lives.
Thank you so much. I love you too. And I'm looking forward to next time, and happy Pride to
Hoorah,
you and
baby.
All of your listeners.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it. Take on the Rational Revolution. We'll see you next week.
I am not a stranger to the dark. Hide away, they say, because we don't want your broken parts. I've learned to be ashamed of all my scars. Run away, they say, no one will love you as you are. But I won't let them break me down to dust. I know that there's a place for